Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball
with Air Sport, the home of rugby in Ireland. Visit airsport.ie.
All right, so you're very welcome along. We're 24 hours away from first against second in rugby in the world in the Aviva. Brian O'Driscoll is here to help us preview the game. There's been a lot of talk about the history between two teams and all that kind of stuff. Let's talk about the game itself. What kind of a game is this going to be?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the weather forecast is for it. I hope it's dry. Hope it's not like England and New Zealand last weekend. Although, I have to say, it was still a very entertaining game and quite a high skill level, all things considered. But I hope it's dry.
Apparently, that's the forecast.
Both sides like to play. And as much as Steve Hansen has been barbed criticism or barbed comments about, you know, the way Ireland play the game and the focus on kicking and on holding possession without giving us any compliments, really, Ireland do like to play with ball in hand, and we know New Zealand do. So it would make for a very entertaining and potentially quite a high-scoring game.
Yeah. We should talk about those comments, right?
Yeah.
And the comments in the build-up to this and the fact that they've been completely obsessed with us since they arrived in this part of the world. Like, I didn't hear them talking about the England team and the build-up to the England game, really. There was a few bits and pieces here and a few tiny bits about Eddie Jones. But in every press conference, he was talking about how Ireland were lying about Conor Murray and he was going to play.
Yeah, he was obsessed by that.
For weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, obviously there's a nervousness there. I think a newfound nervousness because of what happened.
Ultimately, Steve Hansen's always going to be the coach that lost to Ireland for the first time, and he has to live with that. So that scarred him. And now he wants to make sure it's not, you know, he's not the second or you know, the coach that lost, you know, two unforgivable, whatever about once, but unforgivably lose twice. And obviously it's different to Chicago in that we're back home and, you know, there's a great record in the Aviva. So I think there's a nervousness there. And some of the comments that he's been making, I feel have been targeted at his own players less than Ireland, whatever, the Conor Murray stuff. I think that's
yeah,
a bit of gamesmanship and you know, almost willing Joe Schmidt to throw him out there, you know, whether he was fit or not. And him saying that, oh, we want to play against the best Ireland. But I think the comments that he's thrown out into the media, particularly on Sunday, talking about, you know, this is first against second to see who the best team in the world is. It's for his own side to go, come off it. You know, these guys actually think that they could potentially be the best team in the world. We've been that for 8 years now, and we're not relinquishing that anytime soon. So let's really show the world what the differential between one and two is. And speaking to Justin Marshall early in the week at the Outside Broadcasting of the Olympia, and he made a very good point that the difference between New Zealand and the rest of the world after the World Cup in 2015 was stark. It was massive. I don't think anyone was able to touch them. And you consider the points differential in that final, that Australia kind of got within sniffing distance and then they just put them away.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think there's that difference between one and even four and five. And definitely there's the difference between one and two is not as huge as they would like it to be. And they're sitting less comfortably in their seats. And it's good. We've finally gotten their attention. It's taken us a long time to do so, but
but
it's there now. And there's, whether they like to say it or not, there's a respect for what Ireland have achieved, albeit they don't want to give us the kudos for the manner in which we've done it.
So we should take that as a compliment that they're paying attention to us and just accept that it's their mind games and they're trying to wind us up.
It's also their way. It's Steve Hansen's way. It's not like it's anything particularly new. He's always been quite bullish, you know, that comes off winning back-to-back World Cups. You know, someone was quick to point out about the losing sequence he had with Wales, but then he shot back with, you know, with not being able to play the game plan he wanted to play because of the players that he had. So listen, some coaches have an answer for everything, but ultimately Joe Schmidt, you know, has done absolute wonders with an Ireland team that made them as competitive as he has done. Where no other coach was able to get that level of consistency out of his side. And, you know, everyone's talking about Joe Schmidt being the best coach in the world, and even some coaches around world rugby are talking about being the best coach in the world, and that's got to hurt Steve Hansen because,
yeah,
you know, he has had success in the last two World Cups, and remember in the World Cup in 2015, Coach of the Year went to Michael Checa, and you know, the people in New Zealand were appalled at that. But I think you'd be a brave man to bet against Joe Schmidt getting Coach of the Year this year in the World Rugby Awards.
Yeah, so just what Schmidt has done, I think there was definitely a bit of a backlash before last season when we were playing quite a what seemed like a conservative style that we weren't offloading. But that change in style has been fairly pronounced over the last 12 months.
Massive, absolutely. I think obviously our ability to hold through phases has improved no end. Our comfort on the ball, our quality of pass, I think, has improved again. But yeah, I think there's been an evolution over the course of his 5 years. It's not like he hit a plateau in year three and we've just tried to maintain it. I think the game has evolved. And we always have known about his power plays where he wants to set up something to for a strike runner in the third or fourth phase. We know that. But there was question marks around the evolution of the game thereafter. If you were able to control Ireland within three, four phases, it was unlikely they were going to score against you. Whereas now, I think the comfort of being, you know, carrying the ball through 15, 16, 17 phases and then waiting for the opportunity to arise, be it via mismatch or, you know, multiple options. You've got big ball players, and, you know, Devon Toner back in the team this weekend is very close to being as good as Brodie Retallick with ball in hand. Maybe not quite there yet, but his evolution as a player has been mind-blowing, and that's largely down to the coaching that's gone on at national level and a provincial level. So I think we can't underestimate how impressive... I know we talk about it a lot, but how impressive, you know, our model has been, our coaching model has been, to allow these players to evolve into the team they've become.
Yeah, because it did feel like it wasn't a given. It felt like there was a possibility the team could have plateaued. And in fairness to Schmidt, like, even when you think back to it, so it's, even within the power plays, it seems like they've become more intricate, like the involvement of Tadhg Furlong and Twickenham, all that kind of stuff.
I think there's less of a focus on them as well, which is reassuring. I think, yes, they still want to strike and potentially, you know, if you can get a line break or if you can get a score from a power play like they did with Stander, absolutely brilliant. But it's not the be-all and end-all. And I think certainly my time with Leinster and my 1 year with Ireland with Joe, there was very much a focus on them. I think they've taken a step back from that and realised way more of the game is in multi-phase, and I think they've grown the shape and the understanding of what they're trying to do to turn slow ball into fast ball.
I wonder, is it a coincidence that this happens around the same time as Lancaster comes into Leinster with the comfortable and chaos stuff? And like,
it's no doubt helped Joe Schmidt's cause. Absolutely. It's the same and different in what they're doing, and from what I hear, that the intensity of the training in Leinster is every bit that of Ireland, but they you know, they are very comfortable being in stressful environments and stressful situations and playing loosely, and you can see it in their offloading game. And I think, you know, I don't know what number of Leinster players are in the Irish squad for this weekend, but they're, you know, certainly the lion's share of the makeup of the team and that 23-man squad. And lots of them are very, very comfortable with offloading now, where 3, 4, 5 years ago, you know, they weren't. And that only comes from practice, and not just in national camp. That has to come from practicing it every day at provincial level. And that goes as well for players that have evolved massively. I think Peter O'Mahony has become a phenomenal player. This season he's probably Ireland's the standout player in Ireland, just with every aspect to his game. I think he always had that doggedness and the toughness, good at line out time. But I think his small subtleties of offloading here and there, you know, becoming a link player as well as a contact player, that's what you need to keep teams guessing.
There was an interesting bit when Toner came off the bench last week, where Toner was lifting O'Mahony from the back and they'd Tadhg Furlong from the front. So suddenly you've got like this explosive athlete throwing him up and this kind of giant totem pole pushing him up from behind. And he's also unbelievably athletic. Mm. Like, so Toner isn't just in here to catch ball. He's also in there as a lifter from a defensive perspective too.
But he's calling those lineouts too. And so I guess he knows what, you know, lineouts, again, I spoke with Paul O'Connell during the week, and lineouts are something that I've never had to worry myself with. It's about what type of ball are you looking for? And as a 13, when I'm passing in the information to my 10 as to what play I think we should do, he then passes that on to his 9 to say, this is where we want the ball. We, you know, no back really wants fast at 2, you know, because you've got 6 of the lineout, yeah, you know, ready to charge back out on you. The 2 tail gunners are going to fly. So you want 4 or 6 ball, realistically. The back is the best place because you're going to possibly engage that tail gunner, the defending player at the back of the lineout, who could be lifting a pod if they're trying to steal that ball at the back.
Yeah.
So you can't lift and shoot on your 10 at the same time. So it's about trying to maximize the position for yourself to get front, you know, get a good gain line or have a good strike play if you are trying to go wide. So, you know, when it comes to lineouts, Devon knows the variety. He's developed massively under Paul O'Connell, under Leo Cullen, and now he's become an incredibly proficient international caller. And it's not only on him. You will see that he'll go for the guaranteed ball, you know, will be at 4, some movement. But that's, you know, you throw it to the spot where no other player can reach. If like Rory Best's throw is on the money, well, no one can get there. Maybe Luke Charteris, but you know, who's 6'10" for Wales. But other than that, they just can't get there. So if that functions well, he is such a brilliant tool to have in your team.
Yeah, and I think even the story of Toner's evolution is really interesting. But the fact that there was a period maybe 18 months ago when his form wasn't as good as it is now, and people were kind of wondering if he was coming to the end of days. But here we are in the biggest game of the year, and he's first choice. It's pretty amazing from his own perspective to be able to keep Ian Henderson at bay, because Henderson is also a sensation.
Just shows the importance of what, you know, set piece is and line out. And a big focus of what Ireland do is around their set piece. Our scrummage has gotten very good. And you saw where Ireland were able to disrupt the All Blacks when they did beat them in Chicago, that the All Blacks line out fell apart and their scrum was a little bit shaky. And the knock-on effect is they just couldn't get a grasp on the game properly. They couldn't get the ball that they wanted. They couldn't get the gain line that they're after. And rugby becomes quite a simple game. It's a contact game, but whoever wins that collision is very much in the ascendancy. Defences on the back foot versus defences on the front foot. And when you pair it all back, if you can get good quality line-out ball and get your players, you know, running on on that front foot, you stand a great chance of the next phase and the phase after that being a positive one versus a negative one.
Yeah, so what confidence level do you have that we're going to be able to do something like we did in Chicago again? Because we had to score 40-odd points that day.
Yeah, I've looked and done a little bit of an early study this morning and just looked at what the necessity is likely to be on scoring points and conceding points. So I think Ireland in the last 10 games, since they last lost to New Zealand, last 10 home games, they've averaged a concession of about 15-odd points.
That's pretty good.
And I think New Zealand's last 10 games away from home, they've scored 32.
Okay.
So there's your differential. So, and granted, one of those was Japan, it was a 69-pointer, so let's just pare that back a little bit. So high 20s.
Yeah.
So the reality is, it's not often it happens, what happened last weekend, New Zealand, where they were contained to 16 points.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of an anomaly. Even the South Africas and the Australias that play them every year, multiple times a year, they're nearly always, you know, they nearly always have to score 30s, high 30s to beat New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's going to be any different. I think you're going to have to score a lot of points. And I wonder, will Ireland go to the corner a la Argentina last week early on, rather than take those three-pointers. Three-pointers are important, but in reality, you're probably going to have to score 3-4 tries.
Yeah, which is a mindset issue, right? And yet it's kind of how we've approached the game, certainly since the start of the last Six Nations. We seem to have a bit more of a, okay, we're going to be a team that wins games by scoring points as opposed to being a team that brings the opposition down to our level, has a slugfest, beats them in the forwards, wins some penalties and wins 15-12. Like, I mean, maybe the first game against France wasn't like that, but we still were trying to score tries. That's a change, is it?
Yeah, no, it is a change. I think there's a mentality that there's an aggressiveness, particularly with key individuals. I think Johnny wants to go to the corner a lot, and that's not, he doesn't want the pressure of kicking goals. I think he's just feels as though they have that in their armory now, that they can, you know, their maul is very good.
Yeah.
When they get organised, you know, they've got some clever attack plays off maul and off strike plays. So, you know, from close quarters, they feel as though they can get 5-pointers, that they can hold the ball through massive possession, and worst case scenario, they can draw out another penalty. And if they feel that, you know, they've battered away and the opposition have been good defensively, you can always kick a goal. Then it's not you know, throwing the towel in saying we'll take 3 points at this stage.
Yeah.
But if you know, continue to squeeze pressure in that area, the referee comes into play then, and you know, really starts scrutinizing. And you know, particularly when players go to the bin, there's a real element of your attitude shift is so positive that you ratchet up what, you know, the energy that you've been playing with, and it's a deflator for the opposition. As much as everyone else needs to pick their game up to make up for that man that's gone, it's 14-15 can be stark at times.
It's the evolution of our killer instinct in a way. That's kind of over the last 18 months that's where we need to be to win this game. Like, there's a couple of the selection issues were fairly obvious as the first couple of games, the Italy game and the Argentina game were kind of analysed. You know, you can see why Devin Toner comes in. You can see why Rob Kearney comes in.
Sure.
Like,
well, you know, Jordan Armour was terrific against a poor Italian team in Chicago, but we definitely saw areas of vulnerability to his game. He is not as proficient in the air. His kicking game is not nearly as good as Rob Kearney's right now. He has, you know, plenty of time on his side to get that right, but even from a natural perspective, I think Rob Kearney in the air, and always has done, has always looked a lot more confident. I think it's a skill that you can 100% grow, because I think you can see that in someone like Conway, who I would have said was not always brilliant in the air, but has become very good from practice. So it can be a skill that's learned, but there's nothing quite like someone that makes it look easy, and Rob Kearney has always done that. And whether it's come from his Gaelic football playing days, probably, but he, you know, is always comfortable with picking the ball above his head. His left foot looks so natural, and I think defensively and position wise, there's more scrutiny on the fullback for Ireland these days. He's asked to cover more grass because they play the wingers quite high. So Rob Kearney has way more experience and way more nous in understanding what grass he needs to cover.
I'm sure he would have liked a game before playing the All Blacks, coming back after a short period of injury.
Yeah, but he's lean and he looks in great shape. And yeah, listen, nothing can prep you for the intensity of these sort of games, but he'll be fine. You know, I do think that Miles, you know, in the bank already, from a career perspective, stand to you in these games where, you know, it's not new. You're not losing any of that nervous energy where you're going into an element of the unknown as you would do with a Larmer. Whereas Cairns has played against the All Blacks multiple times, and he's beaten them, and
there was,
you know,
the
he's man of the match, you know, in Chicago. So it's fine.
Yeah, the famous chat from Joe in the warm-up where I need a big one for me today in that Chicago game. It's interesting that Larmer makes the bench and that Conway doesn't, because Conway is obviously, his form is fairly sensational.
Yeah, but I think that's become an easy one for Joe, and that is where it potentially can hurt Conway. Because Larmer plays wing fullback in 13, he's an obvious choice for a bench player. And unless Conway lights it up in some way or something else happens where someone else on the team can play in the centre, I just don't see how it's going to change. I understand that Earls can move into the centre, but you know, he's far more effective on the wing. But I think that Larmer now, if he continues, like, his performance against Argentina was okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't,
yeah,
it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great either.
It's a learning.
Absolutely. And I'm very conscious of saying that this guy is a young man. So we need to, because he burst onto the scene with some electric performances, and you expect the world from him now, but he's electric going forward. He has things to learn in his game, and he's slowly doing that with the experience that he's getting.
Yeah, because this is properly his second season, and that second season slump is a real thing.
Yeah.
It becomes a cliche because it's true.
Yeah.
And the only other selection issue really is, this is Kieran Marmion's job as understudy to lose now, given that he got selected. Yeah. But I did think Luke McGrath was brilliant when he came off the bench.
Yeah, he was. I think this is a big call, and it's a statement of intent from Joe Schmidt that Marmion now is his number two guy. Obviously he's obviously shaken off the ankle injury that he picked up at the end of the game. I do wonder, is there an element of not being 100% fit, and it's not great having those guys on the bench?
Okay.
And maybe, you know, that's, I'm guessing a little bit, but let's not take anything away from Kieran Marmion. He's not done anything wrong for Ireland any times he's played in it. A bit like Bundiaki, very, very good, you know, scored some tries. Would you love for his pass to be a little bit quicker? Yeah, but he knows, you know, he doesn't have to be invited twice to go through a gap, and lovely score at the weekend, being very solid defensively. So yeah, I think it's hard to argue the point that he deserves another opportunity in the biggest game that he'll have played for Ireland, for sure.
Yeah.
I know he played against England when Conor Murray was injured 2 seasons ago in Dublin, but this is another step up from that.
Yeah, because it's been billed as the first versus second, and New Zealand are clearly targeting it, and this is the real deal. The Dan Levy situation, I mean, it's heartbreak, obviously, for Sean O'Brien, again, with another injury, but Dan Levy is at the moment playing at a very elite level.
Well, that second half performance was quite something. And I'm a fan of Dan Levy's, but I've always been a huge fan of Sean O'Brien's. I've played with him, I trained with Dan Levy, and so I knew what was coming. But he's, you know, talk about someone that's taken his opportunity, you know, with last year's Six Nations and obviously the summer tour, but then even that 40-minute performance when Sean O'Brien was trucking along nicely, that then Dan Levy made a massive impact, and it was the variety to his game.
Yeah,
he's not the most physical player out there, so he has to rely on his footwork, which I think is very good when he's carrying ball, gets his soft shoulders, likes an offload more than Sean O'Brien. I think it more naturally comes to him. And then on the ground, he got at least a couple of steals and important ones. So the variety to his game, and even the penalty he got. He was kind of trying to plead his innocence when he was accused of tackling while still on the ground.
Yeah.
And he stuck an arm up. He knew exactly what he was doing, but maybe that one was for Joe Schmidt going, I don't know what the ref's talking about.
Yeah,
but yeah.
From one angle, he looked okay, but when real time.
Yeah, when you look at the arm, what's his arm flailing up like that? He knew exactly what he was doing.
Twitch.
But yeah. But you know, that's a small aberration on a 40-minute, huge 40-minute performance. So it's. That we've been very lucky in that, you know, Josh van der Vliet's had a really good season. Tommy O'Donnell's had some big games. Remember, we're not even talking about Jordy Murphy here, who was a mainstay of the Six Nations as well. So we're very lucky with the depth of talent that is in that position. And with Sean O'Brien's disappointment comes a great opportunity for Levy to cement a place. And I just wonder now, is this his opportunity to make the position his own? And you know, with less than a year to the World Cup, does Sean O'Brien then become a bench player?
Yeah.
But
it feels that way.
I just feel this was a seminal moment that, you know, Sean had a big opportunity. Everyone was excited for him to come back and, you know, to really stamp his authority, and he just never got his chance. And now he doesn't get to run a game for 2 or 3 months, whatever it might be. And Levy is the man in possession. And if he plays another great game this weekend, he's copper-facing his opinion in Joe Schmidt's mind. He's never let him down.
The training sessions when Sean O'Brien is back pre-World Cup, and it's him and Levy and Josh van der Vleer all going against each other, they'll be interesting.
Yeah, they will be. They'll be tasty.
Because
all of them have a bit of, you know, in very different ways. Like Levy has an edge to him for sure.
Apparently, early doors of training sessions, he was quite aggressive to the point where people were kind of.
And Shaunie won't take that at all. Shaunie, I think, loves when someone brings that because it gives him, you know, contact can be 70%, 60%, 70%, or even less. It can be kind of touch. And when someone gets a bit more aggressive, Shaunie, it doesn't take long for him to get to 100 quickly. You know, he just needs one excuse, you know, of show of someone overstepping the mark, and he'll sort it out himself. He won't need anyone to ask him. And Josh, as placid and as nice a guy as he is, he's got a different sort of edge. I don't think he's got as much thug, but he's so efficient at what he does, and he makes lots of really good decisions that he's a very, very nice guy to have on your bench.
Yeah, more of an assassin.
Yeah, he is. He just quietly goes about his business, and doesn't. Yeah, he's. I think humility personified, and what you see on the pitch is what you get in person.
Yeah,
a really, really nice guy, but yet has a ruthlessness to him when needs be.
What is the story with the team that New Zealand have named? What do you expect from them, and where are they versus their absolute peak of winning the World Cup 3 years ago?
I think they're a bit away from that, being brutally honest. I think in a couple of positions, I don't think they're as strong in the back row. Obviously, Kieran Reid apart, he's a couple of years older, but I still think he's delivering. Maybe not to the same degree as he was a few years ago, but he's still world class. Justin Marshall was saying that he felt that Ardie Sevilla had possibly played his way into the team ahead of Sam Kane. But again, neither of them are Richie McCaw and will never be, I don't think.
Yeah.
And even Liam Squire, Jerome Kino will take a lot of replacing, having been involved in the last two World Cups, and at his pomp was an exceptional six. I just don't feel as though either of those two flanker positions are up to the calibre of where we've seen New Zealand teams in the past.
And so what's that like when the players are out on the pitch and they realise that like, you know?
Well, listen, I've never played against Liam Squire. This is just from what I'm seeing, but I just don't feel.
But so you would have been playing against McCaw. McCaw does McCaw stuff and you're like, oh shit, that's why everybody says he's so good. But suddenly.
And even watching McCaw, just the cleverness and the shortcuts and the manipulation of referees and the manipulation of situations and the stuff that you don't even know that's going on, the quiet word that he's having with the ref or to his own team or to the opposition. There's so much to him, way more to him than they kind of met the eye. So he's a once in a generation type player, and I think he's, you know, almost irreplaceable. However, they've still got some great quality.
Yeah.
Sevens come in. Let's not feel too sympathetic for them.
Yeah.
But the other positions that I feel as though they've nothing on that 2015 team, nothing is harsh, is have a long way to go, is at centre. I think Nanu and particularly Conrad Smith. Nanu was exceptional. You think back to that World Cup final, you know, the try he scored. But Conrad was, was a class player. You know, the real brains of their opposite, their back line and their operation. And I don't think they've managed to find the next player. Jack Goodhew looks like a nice player, but he's not Conrad Smith, I don't think. And
it feels like there's a bit of chaos when you're watching them at the moment. That there was never a sense of chaos.
Yeah.
When Conrad Smith was there.
Yeah, I don't think that there's the security there in the centre pairing that there was. So Conrad Smith was a phenomenal organiser, and great communicator. He had an engine like a long distance Ethiopian runner. He could just go and go and go, and you could just sense, and he picked up a lot of easy tries, what seemed like easy tries, but he had to be there because he was in great support lines. But I don't feel as though Crotty now, as it is this weekend, even though he broke our hearts in 13, Crotty or Sonny Bill in the form that he's been in the last year or so, I don't feel as though they're as powerful there, as anywhere near as powerful as they were in the World Cup. So there's two areas for me that I think they're a little bit more susceptible, and they're key areas.
We obviously were fairly obsessed with the violence that they meted out in 2016, and it's been a topic for conversation all week. Mm. And Wayne Barnes is obviously listening to everything that's going on all week, and there's the pre-match meeting that the coaches will have with the referees. Like, does any of that matter? Is that all just us talking? Is that all just them trying to lay down the markers? Wayne Barnes immune from the noise?
I suppose immune to a certain degree. I think it's no harm when you feel as though you've been irked, as Ireland feel they were, particularly with the Feketoa incident, that reaffirming with Barnes that this did happen, and to not let anything go. So maybe something that he thinks is a little bit 50-50, he might side with Ireland on this occasion, because referees do love a little bit of balance too over the course of a lifetime. And I can't remember the Jaco Pyper back then, but you know, you're not making up for other referees, you know, perceived errors, but I think they do want to make sure that the penalty count and the fair play count doesn't weigh massively
again you know,
or one way or another. You see referees balancing games up when it's over as a contest, but then giving the losing side two or three late penalties just so the differential might be
9-6. What are you talking about?
13-8 or 13-9 versus 13-3,
which is actually what it really was.
So that those sort of things, so that happens. And we talk the whole time about referees. They have such an important role in the game, clearly, but they do referee on emotion as well, and they try, or they're told to take emotion out of it, but you can't. That decision, the Owen Farrell decision, there's emotion comes into that. There's another incident where I felt England should have been given a penalty in the 78th minute for one of the Kiwis not rolling away from a ruck, and that's a penalty in the first part of the game, but emotion comes into it because there's 1 point on the scoreboard.
Yeah.
And he gives them the benefit of the doubt and tries to find a reason not to penalise them, whereas early on, referees will go, there's a reason for me to penalise you.
Yeah.
So the games are refereed differently over the depending on what's at stake at different times.
Does the crowd have any role in that?
They do, of course.
November Internationals, obviously, is a completely different environment from...
Think about Thomond Park. Have they had a role in, some decisions going their way? Of course they have. So, sure, a crowd has a massive impact on a referee's decision, because they can force that pressure. They can't make something up, but they can add to a thought that a referee is feeling about whether something might have been illegal or stretched beyond the rules, and he wasn't entirely sure. The crowd come in over the top of that copper fastens again his decision.
We don't really have that many 7 o'clock kickoffs in evening kickoffs in Lansdowne Road where the crowd will have had an opportunity to find their voice in the previous few hours.
I'm
suddenly very enthusiastic about that.
It's a strange one. Yeah, we 7 o'clock. We've had more recently the 5:30s.
Yeah,
and I think for me, I like the 5:30 personally as a player, because it's easier. You don't have to cram too much food, and it's not an all day wait. But then you can lie in the morning. So
yeah.
I loved an old 5:30. 7 o'clockers are a bit trickier, but I'm sure they've probably adjusted their schedules to allow for that. So it's not going to shock anyone.
New Zealand are strong favourites for this, 5.5 to 7 points depending on the time of the week and where you're looking. That's about right. They should be favourites. They're the best team in the world.
Yeah, they should be favourites. They should be, because they've been beaten twice since we played them, the Lions and South Africa. And maybe Australia have beaten them in there in a Bledisloe Cup match as well. Maybe that's three times. That's enough by their standards.
Yeah.
Since 2016.
2016, yeah.
Yes. So
not a whole heap.
Not a whole heap, but not inconsequential at the same time. Where there's players that in New Zealand that just do not expect to lose.
Yeah.
Sam Whitelock has, for his first 100 tests, had lost less than 10%. So when you look at those stats, they just expect to win. But they should be favourites, because they have historically been able to create lots more opportunities and take more of their chances and put teams away. And when they're hot, if they're 9 out of 10, if they play 9 out of 10 and we play 9 out of 10, they win.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. So we have to play our 9 out of 10 and contain them to a 7, and then we got a great shot.
Yeah, Luke Fitzgerald was predicting a 2 tries victory for the All Blacks. What do you think is going to happen?
Do you know what? It's a toss of a coin. You know, I thought early on in the week that I'd be, or last week before the injury came in, I was pretty bullish, and maybe that's just the way I always am in advance of big games where I get less and less confident the closer you get to it. And I wondered, was it worth a punt of trying to have a go at Ireland to win by more than 7. You know, we won by 2 scores in Chicago. Very difficult to beat at home. But I just have decided not to put that bet on. Because I want to hold on to my money, ultimately. And I don't know if... I think it'll only be... I genuinely think it'll only be a 1-score game. Probably... if I was, had a gun to my head, I'd probably say tip New Zealand to win it, but really would not shock me at all, because I think there's a big performance in this Irish team as well. Just can we stop their space and contain them and stop Beauden Barrett? That's a lot of it comes down to that.
Last point on this is that their game against England would give everybody a lot of hope, but it felt like the whole point of them talking about us in the build-up to the England game, it felt like this is their big game too. The England game was important. Okay, it's Twickenham, they obviously, but I don't think they rate Eddie Jones that much now, and I don't think they rate that England team, but they rate us. Mm. It felt like they were a little bit distracted by this, and so I expect them to be way better this week than they were last week.
So do I. I think they'll be a lot better. And interesting to see Damian McKenzie back in the team. You know, I think he got the shepherd's hook with 10 minutes to go to try and, you know, shore it up. He's box office, but gosh, he's loose in contact, and you can be sure that Ireland will have earmarked that. He was the one that coughed up the ball in the loss to South Africa in the last minute or two. He turned it over at least 3 times at the weekend. If you can get hold of him, you know, he can be stripped, but it is a big ask to, can you get hold of him? He's very, very exciting, and if you kick loosely to him, he'll make you pay. So there were... there were signs of vulnerability where we defended in pods of front rows at times. Yeah. Last weekend in phase play, that you've got to cut all that out. You've got to realise who you're defending with. And if you have 1, 2 and 3 defending together, they will pick that apart. Argentina managed to do it once or twice, didn't put line breaks into scores. But there's no better team to do that than the Kiwis.
Argentina were finding line breaks fairly straightforward in the tight, which was the complete opposite of how they beat us in the World Cup when they just flung the ball wide and beat us out. I was like, that's not great.
And maybe there's a little bit of mind game there with them where...
come on and beat us that way?
Well, there's a bit of, you know, Ireland being super conscious of not getting too tight, and then as a result maybe thinking they're looking at striking wide, and then we're a little bit susceptible through the middle. They had 1 or 2 plays, you know, that Brumbies loop play where, you know, Johnny usually gets it around the back, but actually, you know, they went 12 and hit 13 short, and he got between Bundy and Johnny, and you just can't do that. That's a relatively simple one for Bundy not to, you know, he's got to mark 2. It's a difficult play. That's why Leinster uses it so much, because it's a difficult one to defend.
Yeah.
But I think you've got I think Addison did very well, but you've got a phenomenal defender in Gary Ringrose. So I think that will shore things up as well, give a bit more security to Bundy too.
Yeah.
And he's played with Gary before, would have been, you know, he hasn't much experience playing with Addison. So I think all of that will be better. But you can be sure if they offer opportunities to the Kiwis, they will absolutely take them, and they do like those wide channels. So I'm excited to see what defensively Ireland can do. Can they keep their width when they are punctured in and around the ruck, and but yet still maintain strength out wide?
Yeah, Andy Farrell, I've had an interesting week, I'm sure, looking at the videos and coming up with a plan. Brian, enjoy the game. Thanks very much.
A lot. Cheers.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball
with Air Sport. Every Champions Cup and now every Pro 14 game only on the Air Sport Pack.